Margot Adler has reported for NPR for 30 years now. For all of that time, and longer, she's lived in an apartment overlooking the huge green oasis of Central Park. When a storm this week destroyed as many as 100 trees there, for Margot, it wasn't just another story to cover. It's personal.
Central Park is my backyard. It's right across the street. It's my country house, my birding forest, my nature. I have watched scarlet tanagers here and great egrets and morning warblers. I've seen a woman in a wheelchair feeding four baby raccoons at dusk, and I followed the trees from season to season. There are many species of oaks and maples, horse chestnuts, London planes, elms, beeches, white ash. I could go on and on. From my window, nothing looks different today. The huge rains of this summer have made the park luxurious, but enter the park, and the devastation of Tuesday's storm is everywhere. No one has seen anything like it in decades. The storm, which meteorologists called a microburst, not a tornado, did its worst damage right where I live, in the West 90s and 100s. Walking out at 6 a.m. on Wednesday, I saw at least 30 trees, oaks, ginkgos, maples, many more than 100 years old, totally uprooted. Today, there is yellow caution tape all over the park, closing pathways and warning runners and dog walkers of the danger from falling branches. Right where I enter the park, there's a rock outcropping on the left. At first, I couldn't even understand what I was seeing, the huge brown mass behind the rock. It was an enormous root system of a tree upended. Then I saw another and another. Near the pool around 100th Street, it looks like a tornado has passed. After walking several miles to see the damage, I went to look for my favorite tree, a huge London plane that three people holding hands would never get their arms around. It's still there with only a few branches torn off. The death of these old friends is so sad. At the same time, there's something so beautiful and primal about the power of a storm, of nature still beyond human control. There's a wonderful book that is still available. It's called Tree Trails in Central Park. It takes you on walks identifying tree by tree. So if I open it to the chapter that starts on my block, it tells me that right to the left of the entrance are two European willows and a horse chestnut tree. It even says things like, next to lamppost 9314 is a Chinese elm. I wonder how many entries in this book would have to be rewritten now.
That's NPR's Margot Adler in New York Central Park after a windstorm destroyed many trees there.
Economists say one reason healthcare is so expensive is that it's not set up like a traditional market. It's full of peculiarities. Our Planet Money team examined one key player, doctors, and asked a simple question. In economic terms, what role does the doctor play? Hannah Jaffe Wolt and David Kestenbaum have our story.
David, I think I got it.
All right, go ahead.
Here's my proposal. Doctors are like your mom. Economically speaking, they've got your best interests at heart. They take care of us, deliver our babies, they check our ears when we're little.
They see us naked.
Exactly. Mom material. Here, let me show you.
Hello.
Hi, Ma.
Hey, Han.
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I have a really bad headache.
You do?
Yeah.
Sorry to hear that.
My throat has, like, been killing me all morning, and I'm just tired all the time.
For your headache, it would probably help to take some Tylenol. I know you don't like taking things, but it would be a good idea for you to go and get some.
See? She listens, cares, prescribes.
Good, Hannah. Good. Yeah, that's cute. Yeah, the analogy kind of works, especially since I've been paying your mom to put up with your whining.
Yeah, so my mom theory runs aground there. My ma does not get paid.
But doctors do. In fact, most get paid for every single sale, every surgery, every procedure. So I have another proposal. The doctor is a salesman, just like this guy, Mo Azzalo, who sold me sunglasses on the street.
This $7, sir.
Now, can I haggle and give you $6 instead?
$6? How about $6.99?
All right, $6.99, deal.
Wow, David, tough bargainer.
I saved a penny.
Okay, look, this is what makes doctors such strange economic actors. Nobel Prize economist Kenneth Arrow, he wrote about this in the 1960s, how crazy this is, that doctors have a financial incentive to act as a salesman. So, and that is why we have things like the Hippocratic Oath, to remind them to act more like your mom. So I asked several economists, who, economically speaking, does the doctor resemble most? And they all named the same one profession.
My name is Ari Cohen. The name of the shop is ABC Ericsson. And we are the car doctors, if that's how you want to call us.
That's right. Your doctor is an auto mechanic. Because of this one big issue that you don't get with the mom or the street salesman, the information problem.
The information problem. For example, the other day, this guy comes into Ari's shop. Good guy. He's got a Buick. He tells him, every time I step on the brakes, the steering wheel, the whole thing in the car shakes. And Ari says, oh, no problem. Really simple. $320 fix. But then?
And we check a little bit more into it, and we find out that the wheel bearings have some play, and the axles out of balance. They bent, or the shaft is not aligned right.
And how much more is that going to cost?
It's varies on the car, but like on the Buick, the wheel bearings, they're a little bit expensive, so it can be like another $1,000.
We've all been in this situation. You take the car in, Ari's a good guy, but you don't really know. We as customers, we have an information problem. It's the same with healthcare. Patients can't always judge whether we need surgery, we don't know what procedures are necessary and which aren't, and doctors, they don't always know what drug or what treatment works best.
And this is why when you hear proposals for how to fix healthcare, you hear talk about changing how doctors are paid or that we need more research so you don't have these information problems. So the doctor is in this strange spot. And unfortunately, that is not the only strange thing in this market. You are strange.
We are strange, the consumers. If you think about the guy with that Buick, he may just decide his car is not worth fixing. But if you take your grandmother to the doctor, you'll pay $10,000, $50,000, whatever, because you love her.
And because you're insured. But that's for another time. What happens when your half mom, half salesman, mechanic doctor has an appointment with your price is no obstacle, life loving grandmother?
David Kestenbaum.
And I'm Chana Jaffe Walt, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. This was a week when private insurance companies seemed to move closer to the kind of health care overhaul they want. The insurance companies started this year at the table, as they say, with President Obama. But they put up a fierce fight against a so-called public plan, a government insurance plan, as part of the bill.
Now there are signs the Obama administration might accept a plan without it, and the administration has turned its rhetoric against the insurance companies. The private firms deeply involved in this debate include WellPoint, whose CEO is Angela Brawley. Her company has 34 million customers. Do you assume that the public plan, the public option, as the administration calls it, is dead?
You know, we don't know if the public plan is dead or not. We obviously have some thoughts and concerns about the public plan because we know now there's a lot of cost shifting that occurs between Medicare and Medicaid paying lower. And, you know, each of us who has employer-provided coverage or provided coverage through the individual market, per family, we're paying about $1,500 in that cost shift. And if the public plan were to come to fruition, we would expect that cost shifting to exacerbate. And,
you're saying that you think that if there were a public insurance plan, they would force down rates that they would pay for medical coverage and hospitals and doctors would just pass on the difference to private insurance plans, your customers, pretty much.
That's right, Steve.
Although, isn't there some fairness in the administration's contention that your concern is not necessarily cost shifting so much as you don't want the extra competition?
You know, there is competition in the health insurance market. There are over 1,300 health insurance companies competing.
Whoa. They don't all compete in the same place for the same customers. Aren't there huge swaths of America where there's only a handful of companies to choose from?
We think there's pretty broad competition, particularly among the major national insurance companies. So, you know, really what's interesting about this debate is it's shifted to this question about insurance companies, when where we started out in the discussion was about health care reform.
I'd like to play some tape from the president here speaking on August 15th, and he certainly was talking about companies like yours.
In the past few years, premiums have nearly doubled for the average American family. Total out-of-pocket costs have increased by almost 50%. That's more than $2,000 per person. And nobody's holding these insurance companies accountable for these practices.
Angela Brawley, is the president right?
You know, President Obama's focused on what I think is a misconception about health insurance premiums and what is driving the increase in premiums and the coinsurance piece that we're talking about. You know, for every dollar spent on health care in the U.S., less than a penny goes to insurance company profits. To say that the crisis in health care relates to a penny of the healthcare cost, I think, is misdirected, and we need to focus again on healthcare reform.
Let's sort out that number if we can. A lot of money is spent in the healthcare system on Medicare, and so that's nonprofit. There are a lot of nonprofit insurance companies, and they spend money, and so that's not profits. So if we actually did your percentage of profits at WellPoint, which is a for-profit company, you're making more than 1% profits, aren't you?
Our profit is in the 3-4% range. I think this year around 4%. When you look, though, across healthcare, there are profit margins in a number of sectors around healthcare that are 3, 4, 5 times ours. If you look at biotech margins or pharmaceutical companies or device manufacturers, they're 3, 4, 5, 6 times the margin in the health insurance business. And the irony of that is it is our job to get to the efficiency of healthcare.
There might be another irony there as well, because if it's your job to make things efficient and the cost of doing business keeps going up year after year after year, doubling in 5 years, as the president says, somebody might suggest you're not doing a very good job.
We are really making inroads in terms of how this higher quality care that is expensive can be delivered most effectively.
You certainly are correct when you say that the tone of the debate has shifted, because it appeared in the spring that the health insurance companies were on the same page as the White House, or close to it, or at least talking to the White House. And now there's certainly a different tone, not only in the president's statements, but in some of his supporters or liberal groups. Here's an ad I'd like to play you from a group called Americans United for Change, which supports big changes to health care.
Why do the health insurance companies and Republicans want to kill President Obama's health insurance reform? Because they like things the way they are now. Ed Hanway, CEO of insurance giant Cigna, makes $12.2 million a year.
That's the ad from Americans United for Change. Is that fair?
You know, I don't think it's fair because, Steve, we came to the table very early on for reform. We offered really meaningful solutions. And so I think that's gotten lost in the debate. I don't think most Americans know that we really came to the table early on as a proponent for some real solutions to health care reform.
I'm glad you mentioned that. If I'm not mistaken, WellPoint spent about $2.4 million directly lobbying the government last year. Of course, insurance companies and other health industry companies have drastically increased their spending this year. The Blue Cross plans with which you folks are involved spent something like $5 million in lobbying in the second quarter. I could give a bunch of other numbers, but I'm just curious what you're getting for your money.
What we want to do is be offering good solutions in the debate, which we did really early on. People need to know we're at the table committed to real reform, sustainable reform that will help us get all Americans covered.
But I'm wondering what you get for those millions of dollars that you spend lobbying in Washington.
Our commitment is to make sure that we are getting the education and the information around how it really works, giving real-time examples. And I think that's important for all Americans to understand in this debate.
And you have to hire the lobbyists to get the access to make your case to lawmakers.
I think there's lots of folks who are very engaged in the debate, and to be at the table and offer these solutions is really important to us.
Angela Brawley of WellPoint, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Poets often use many words to say a simple thing. That line from the song Fly Me to the Moon sums up the problem some poets face when they turn to long-form fiction. That's the situation, at least, for poet Jimmy Santiago Baca, according to our reviewer Alan Chews. Allen says Baca has overwritten in writing his first novel, A Glass of Water.
A husband and wife, Casimiro and Nopal, and their two sons, Lorenzo and Vito, cross over from Mexico into the U.S. and try to make a life there. Out of this, Baca tries to make a novel. Sometimes he employs lyrical bursts of language, sometimes he uses fragments of scenes and fluid naturalistic sequences. He does all of it in such an amateurish way that he seems to be working out his aesthetic problems right there in front of us on the page. The parents, Casimiro and Nopal, though earnest and honest, both come to bad ends. Casimiro is felled by a stroke, and Nopal is murdered after a rape. Their two boys, Lorenzo and Vito, make their own way. Lorenzo works the land and gets involved with Carmen, who's studying migrant workers. Vito becomes a prize fighter filled with talent and rage. The entire book goes back and forth, sometimes in short scenes of the rape of Nopal and out of Vito's boxing career that work beautifully, at other times in summary and less than coherent lyrical response from the dead mother or the mind of the incapacitated father. In other words, a poet has made a mess of a novel. But sometimes he does it in glorious fashion, as in the moment poets do best with moments, not with linear narratives, when Lorenzo approaches Carmen in the fields. Her hair smelled like clear blue sky along the river, we hear. Her breath like cottonwood leaves. And then there was a hush as she groaned. Then silence followed as she shivered, a reverent, quiet shiver, as if monks were chanting music from within her, stirring in his soul a sense of ancient belonging.
The novel is A Glass of Water by Jimmy Santiago Baca. Our reviewer is Ellen Chuse. Cash for Clunkers, the surprise success of the summer in jump-starting the auto industry, will reach the end of its run and shut down as of 8 p.m. Eastern Time this coming Monday. That announcement came this afternoon from Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. The $3 billion program offers up to $4,500 in rebates if you trade in your older gas guzzler for a more fuel-efficient model, and it's spurred enough sales to create a huge backlog and a squeeze for car makers and dealers alike. Joining us to talk about the program's last days is NPR's Brian Naylor. Brian, why is this program ending?
Simply put, Melissa, they're running out of money. They had $3 billion allocated for this program, and the Department of Transportation says that as of today, there are enough orders in the pipeline to add up to $1.9 billion, meaning there's a little over $1 billion left. And so they're talking about making a soft landing so that the program can come to an end. And they've decided to give everyone about 4 days' notice and bring it to a halt on Monday.
So if you're going to try to take part in Cash for Clunkers, you have until Monday to do it. There would still be enough money in the pipeline to cover those new deals.
That's what they say, that the way the sales have been going so far, that there will be enough money. But you're going to have to get in there this weekend to make your claim.
Now, after Monday, Brian, remember before when Cash for Clunkers ran out of money, Congress came up with $2 billion more. Any chance that that would happen again?
It's going to be fun to watch. Congress could allocate more money. It's clearly a very popular program, not only with the auto industry, automakers, but auto dealers, of which there are several in just about every member of Congress's district. So the question is whether Congress wants to set aside more billions for this. There is at least one bill in the pipeline that would make a clunker-like program part of the permanent tax code. But there's likely to be a lot of debate. There was a lot of objections when it was extended the last time from people who said that this was an unfair aid to one particular industry.
And Brian, complaints along the way. We talked about the backlog of deals that are supposed to be going through, dealers that have not gotten reimbursed by the government for the rebates that they've handed out. Does the shutdown change the situation one way or the other for the dealers?
Well, no. I mean, I think that some of the dealers are hurting largely because they're putting out the money first before they're getting reimbursed from the government. The reason they haven't been reimbursed is that there is a logjam in the system. The dealers, I think, contributed in part because there was a huge backlog. They were cutting deals for this program before the program was officially implemented. It's a very complex process. The dealers have to provide a lot of information. Consumers have to provide a lot of information. And the Department of Transportation was not ready. They only had about 30 days to ramp up for this. Secretary Ray LaHood said yesterday they've tripled the number of employees, private and public employees, that are working on the program. And so the hope is that without too much more delay, they'll be able to get things under control.
Brian, what do the numbers show about how many cars have been junked, replaced through the Cash for Clunkers program?
Well, so far, the Department of Transportation says 457,000 transactions have been recorded in the pipeline right now. So we can assume that that's that many cars, assuming they all go through. If you extend it up until Monday night, my rough math, that adds up to about 600,000 clunkers that will have been taken off the road and replaced with new cars at the end of this program.
Brian, thank you very much.
Thanks, Melissa.
It's NPR's Brian Naylor talking about the end this coming Monday of the Cash for Clunkers program.